I tested 330 strains spanning 157 species, and I found that there were, 100 species or so capable of degrading these structures and directly degrading these structures, and their growth properties were enhanced. There were lots of really amazing findings in that work that support the notion that, you know, it's not just bifidos that are important to the infant gut.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hello, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest, we're delighted to have her with us, is Simone Rennick. Simone, you're very welcome to the podcast. And can you give us a little précis of your career to date, how you come to be where you are and what you work on, please?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, thank you so much for the invitation to participate in the podcast. I'm very happy to be here. So I began at the University of Guelph. I started there as an undergraduate student in the biochemistry program. And I had done some volunteer work and some summer research with Dr. Emma Allen Virko, the end of my undergrad studies. And I just fell in love with studying the microbiota, especially the infant gut microbiota. And I decided to stay on to do my PhD with her. And while I was doing my PhD there, I studied the interactions of human milk oligosaccharides, these really special sugars found in human milk, and their interactions with gut bacteria isolated from infants, and then also communities as well, using in vitro models. Since then, I've moved on to the Mother Milk Infant Center of Research Excellence at the UC San Diego campus for my postdoc. And there I'm continuing to study how components of human milk foster the development of the infant gut microbiota. Right now, I'm particularly interested in the milk microbiota, but I'm also continuing research on human milk oligosaccharides and also doing some mouse work as well.
I always say to people, you know, if you want some evidence that the microbiota is important to human health, just consider the fact that, you know, mom makes sugars in her milk that her baby simply cannot digest and puts a lot of energy and effort and genetic capacity into doing that. What's your sense of the importance of that, and maybe what happens when that's missing if a baby, for whatever reason, has to go on to formula milk from birth?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I completely agree. Taking an evolutionary perspective on this, there's a large amount of maternal investment in producing these structures in her milk that the human body just lacks the enzymes to digest them. So those sugars must be there for some significantly important reason and provide some fitness advantage to the offspring, both in the short term and also in the long term. And then that's evident in the infants that receive inadequate or no amounts of milk. They are now predisposed to a range of diseases, both during infancy, but also lifelong conditions as well.
Can you talk to us, Simone, about what do we know about how those human milk sugars get fermented and some of the exciting work you've done in expanding our knowledge of the strains involved in that fermentation?
So what I had done during my PhD was I used in vitro models to mimic infant gut microbiota communities, and I treated them with HMOs, and I measured changes in their composition and then also their metabolic output. And I found that when you provided a wide range of structures, I had isolated or had obtained isolated structures from pooled milk samples. And I found that the communities rapidly degraded those structures, and there were increased abundances of microbes generally associated with health, such as Fecalia bacterium and Akkermansia species, and also a suppression of potentially pathogenic microbes, Clostridioides difficile, for example. And then there were also fermentation byproducts, short-chain fatty acids, a range of amino acids, all of which in theory would be available to the host. And then I was also interested in the individual components of these communities, the strains themselves. So I isolated these strains and I tested their individual abilities to interact with HMOs because the research is largely focused on Bifidobacterium species. And of course, we know they're associated with health and they're dominant members of the breastfed infant gut, but they're not the only members present. The infant gut, they're diverse. They have lots of different taxa present. So I was interested in how these other strains, if they're capable of directly metabolizing the structures. And I tested 330 strains spanning 157 species. And I found that there were, 100 species or so capable of degrading these structures and directly degrading these structures. And their growth properties were enhanced. There were lots of really amazing findings in that work that support the notion that, you know, it's not just bifidos that are important to the infant gut.
And Simone, when babies are weaned, and so as they stop getting these HMOs, do those microbes then with these very specialized sugar degradation and uptake pathways, do they tend to disappear or do they turn their attention to other sources of complex sugars in the diet?
So it's mixed. It really depends on the strains that we're talking about and even the individuals too and diet that they're receiving. I think for some of these microbes, they will switch. Bacteroides, we know, are capable of metabolizing a range of oligosaccharides derived from plant material, as well as the HMOs. But then other taxa, for example, B. infantis, we know its abundance drops almost to undetectable levels at the cessation of breastfeeding.
I wonder, because of the fact that you're an expert in the in vitro systems where you're able to explore how a collection, like a full consortium work, and you've also done very exciting work with exenic cultures where you just have isolates and just looking at each by themselves. I wonder how the work you've done on isolated cultures has informed how you think about when you do the in vitro fermentation models and things like that.
Yeah, of course. In a community, they're functioning as a community. The microbes that are better able to degrade the sugars will act on them rapidly and produce fermentation byproducts, but even just monosaccharides from the sugars too, making those available to other community members that may not have been able to directly metabolize the HMOs. So they're functioning as a community. And at the individual level, even though a lot more strains are able to directly metabolize the HMOs, sometimes they take a lot longer to turn on the necessary machinery to import and metabolize those structures. So in a community, they may not necessarily be the first ones to access the sugars. Some other taxa that are more well-equipped will get to them first. So you can't necessarily say that how a microbe behaves in a monoculture is how it's going to behave in a community. It's very, very different.
Did you ever consider, Simona, and, you know, we have the genetic capacity to produce these HMOs and mom makes them and puts them in the milk and gives them to the baby. Why not just have evolved to produce these sugars in the gut ourselves?
I'm trying to think about, you know, what I've read in the literature about the types of structures present in the gut, and some of them do resemble HMOs depending on the genetic makeup of the mom. For example, fucose, if the mom is secretor positive for the enzyme alpha-1-2 fucosyl transferase, there are going to be fucosylated structures with this linkage in the gut that is available to those microbes. But I think a lot of that research is still really its infancy, no pun intended. And actually, one of the studies that I'm working on right now at the Mommy Corps at UCSD, we are investigating the different combinations between exogenous and endogenous fucose alpha-1-2 fucosylated structures to understand what's more important in terms of driving the development of the infant gut and the immune system.
Colin, I wonder if you have some thoughts about your question.
No, I don't. It just popped into my head, so I thought I'd ask an expert. I was thinking actually about the kind of in vitro models are wonderful because you can set them up, you can sample them continuously. There's no ethics involved, and other than getting the original samples, maybe. But of course, the host is missing. I guess that's what put into my head. What if the host was producing sugars that the community could use? Can you tell us something about the kind of in vitro models you use and do you just have to accept that the host isn't there, or is there anything you can do in terms of introducing mucus or cell lines or anything to mimic the presence of the host?
The specific type of in vitro model that I used, it was a single stage continuous flow bioreactor, and host factors like mucin, we tried to mimic that by adding dissolved mucin in the media. Of course, that doesn't very well recapitulate the intestinal lining, because that's a solid lining that microbes can adhere to. There have been efforts, I think, by other labs and groups to better mimic the mucosa lining. They add beads that are coated in mucus that would give the microbes something to adhere to. My model, or what I worked on, I thought of it more as an advantage to lack the host factors or the host environment, because I was interested in only the microbes and how they were interacting. I know that there are other models out there that try to incorporate aspects of the intestinal cell lining, but now they face challenges of accurately mimicking the oxygen levels within their models, because host cells need oxygen, but the lumen of the gut is anaerobic.
Yeah, I was thinking as well in terms, and we run into these exact same problems, of the importance of spatial relationships, you know, that microbes may be in, obviously they're in communities, but in your systems, in our systems, they're in planktonic communities. So they're floating freely, and presumably in the gut, they're very often in more resembles a fixed community, where a microbe might actually digest a sugar and immediately pass it to the one next to it, rather than just put it out there into the ether for anyone to consume.
I imagine, and then sampling accurately the different areas of such a model would also present quite a challenge. So I think, you know, it's a give and take.
Are you using the same systems for the human infant gut as you've done for, like, horse, your studies on the equine models and things? Are you basically using the same in vitro type systems overall, like a single bioreactor and so on?
Yeah. So the equine model, I didn't drive that study, but for that study, we did introduce bits of hay into the vessels to provide the microbes with a surface that they would adhere to, because I think that the gut dynamics in a horse is significantly different from in a human. So we just wanted to experiment with trying to recapitulate that a bit better.
Okay.
And do you know, is this common throughout all mammals, that all mammalian moms secrete a variety of sugars into their milk? Or is it more pronounced in humans or in primates? Or do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so it is drastically more pronounced in humans. In fact, humans have the highest concentration of oligosaccharides, between 15 to 20 grams per liter. Not a lot of studies have been done outside of humans and domesticated animals, but for example, cows, bovine milk contains less than 1 gram per liter oligosaccharides.
And you also spoke a moment ago about the milk microbiome. Mm-hmm. What? Can you explain that to us?
So I think for many of the more recent studies that have been wondering around the same questions about if it's just contamination from the skins or if very just shallowly present microbes, or if it's actually microbes within the mammary gland. And I think to take this into account, for a lot of studies, including my own, we first asked donors to express a little bit of milk that's discarded, and then we continue to collect milk for our experimentation. And we are finding that there are live microbes present within the mammary gland. The source of these microbes is still largely unknown. They do resemble the compositions of microbes that you would find on the skin, as well as the oral cavity. So likely a mixture from the infant's oral cavity from suckling and the mom's skin around the nipple. But there have been reports of anaerobic bacteria present in the milk microbiome as well. I think that touches a bit on the enteromammary pathway, where microbes could be transitioned from the mom's gut to her milk as a source for the infant, to seed the infant's gut with anaerobic bacteria. But that is still, there's still a lot of ongoing research.
Do they have this specialized machinery for processing the HMOs as well? Because you'd imagine if that's where they live, they would be good at doing that.
Currently, there are no studies, as far as I know, that are looking at the ability of these microbes, the wider diversity of these microbes, to interact with HMOs or to metabolize them. The only one that comes to mind is one study out of our lab group, actually, that only looked at two strains of Staphylococcus aureus. And they found that in the presence of HMOs, these two strains were their growth was increased, but they did not directly metabolize the structures. But beyond these two strains, there are no other studies that have been published to date looking at milk microbes and their direct ability to use HMOs.
Going back to the sugars and how the human milk is very diverse, one of the things that I think a lot of people are surprised about is that the sugars themselves are expressed differently as the, you know, over the course of gestation and preterm versus term and the early life of the infant. So how do you account for that? Do you get donor milk? Do you account for the gestational age of the infant when you're forming the pooled samples? Or do you try to concentrate on targeting the age of the infant, so to speak, you know, the milk according to the stage of development of the infant to kind of account for the sugar profiles?
Mm-hmm. So for my work, I'm interested in infants that are between 3 to 6 months of age. Okay. My work right now, I think younger than 3 months, their gut microbiota is also influenced strongly by the mode of birth between vaginal or cesarean section. But then from about 3 months, the strongest influencing factor on the gut microbiome is the mode of feeding.
In that age range, are the fucosylation and the sealation of the HMO is about similar from 3 to 6 months, or do they change in terms of how the sugars are presented to the, you know, for fermentation?
From what I know, 3 to 6 months, they're going to be quite similar. Of course, there's a lot of individual variation too. So it really depends on a lot of factors. I think a lot of the changes occur much earlier on.
Yes, that's what my colleagues have studied, have been the preemies and the, you know, the late preterm. So it probably is more stable by the time you're looking at them at 3 to 6 months. Okay.
And Simone, it would seem pretty obvious maybe to, you know, someone outside the field. Well, why doesn't the infant milk formula industry just simply put these HMOs into bovine milk? And when babies, you know, for whatever reason, sometimes it's very good reasons why a baby might have to be on formula, that we would redress this balance. What are the technical difficulties? Or do you think it would even be a good idea to load up bovine milk with human milk oligosaccharides for formula-fed babies?
So the infant formula companies are beginning to put HMO structures into their products. The majority of brands out there, they're only incorporating a single structure into fucosylactose, but there are more and more formulas becoming available with more structures. And I think recently there's even a formula with 6 structures that was recently tested. The thing is, the formula companies, they're incorporating the HMOs at a very low concentration. And at that concentration, I'm not really sure how effective these structures are at influencing the developing infant gut microbiota. I think it's really complicated because it's a very sensitive topic. There's a host of reasons why parents would choose or be unable to provide milk at adequate concentrations or at adequate times. So it's a really complex issue. I think the formula companies, on one hand, the incorporation of structures could be seen as an advantage, but at the same time, I'm not sure if the research is quite there yet to support the use of these structures outside of the complex matrix of human milk. I think a lot more research needs to be done first. Breast milk is personalized nutrition between an infant and its parent, and there's a huge genetic component of that influences the structures that are present in the milk that an infant receives from its own mom. Whereas when you incorporate these structures into formula, it now becomes a one-size-fits-all model. And we don't know how these structures are going to influence individual infants. We really don't know. I don't know. I don't think the research is there yet.
What advice would you have for other young scientists that are going into microbiology and the kind of experiments that you do?
I think what really made a difference to me during my journey through grad school and now my postdoc was just finding good mentors, finding the right mentors. Of course, your PI, but even beyond your PI, other graduate students in your lab, outside of your lab, pursuing similar things, but even outside of your program as well, just finding those right people to bounce ideas off of and just have great discussions about your work. I think a lot of my great ideas came just from having conversations with my peers and also my PI. And I've had excellent PIs, but even just reaching out to other researchers too, even outside of your own university.
Simone, listen, thank you so much for joining us. We've really enjoyed talking to you, and we wish you every success in your career.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to participate.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.